From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in today for Suzette Gerlot. And welcome to Worldviews. Today on the program, I'll speak with Mitchell Smith, the chair of the Department of International and Area Studies at the University of Oklahoma, about how Greece arrived at its current economic crisis.
There was a huge influx of capital into Greece, and it was not necessarily directed and used in productive ways.
Then we'll hear Suzette's conversation with geographer Kathleen O'Reilly about the gendered and social issues of sanitation projects in India.
Building a toilet meant that women really never had a reason to leave the house, and that is of concern. That's concerning.
Health and development in rural India, right after this news update from NPR. This is World Views. I'm Rebecca Cruz. We're joined today by Mitchell Smith, a professor here at the University of Oklahoma that specializes in the European Union and Europe in general. Mitchell, we're going to talk with you a little bit about Greece. Obviously, this has been a big story the last month. Can you explain to us kind of the curves in the road that Greece has undertaken with the European Union?
It's difficult to know where to start. I think if we start from the present, what we see is a situation in which the Greek people are continuing to suffer from an accumulation of misery that they've experienced for now more than five, going on 6 years. And I think if there's a theme to all of the discussion, it would be sort of a quest for hope. From my perspective, the question is, where does hope come from for the Greek people?
Okay, so you said this is something that's been building for the last 5 or 6 years, some situations that came out of the financial crisis in 2008. But we could even go further back to Greece joining the euro in 2001, then the Olympics perhaps. But what happened there?
Right. Well, Greece's membership in the eurozone was delayed by a couple of years. And what most people don't realize is that during the first few years of membership, Greece actually did quite well. If you look at the data for the sort of first half of the 2000s, 2001 to 2005 or 6, Greece did quite well. Their economic growth was solid and their performance was good. There was modernization of the economy taking place. At the same time, I think some of the seeds of the subsequent problems were being sown during that period in two ways. One, there was a huge influx of capital into Greece. That capital flooded in, and it was not necessarily directed and used in efficient and productive ways. And so there's a lost opportunity really to modernize and develop the Greek economy further at that point in time. And then I think the consequences of that began to emerge over the next few years during the latter 2000s and up to the point where we are today, which is a very difficult state of affairs for Greece.
And when they joined the euro, there was also some indication a couple of years later that there may have been some fudging of the records as well, that they may have presented themselves in a slightly more favorable situation than their economy actually was in, though you said they did fairly well for the first couple of years.
Absolutely. There absolutely was fudging, and there continued to be fudging during their early years of membership. It was around 2008 that a Greek government revealed that the deficit figures were much worse, I think something like triple the deficit rate that had been announced. And then financial markets began to get wind of the real problems in Greece. But their fiscal practices were shoddy, to say the least. And then it was a new Greek government, that revealed the depth of these problems.
Okay, and then things got particularly bad in 2009, and there was the need for some sort of bailout or a loan in 2010, some austerity measures that were viewed by the Greek people in pretty harsh terms. And that's been going on for the last couple of years. And then in late 2014, we see some election upheavals, early 2015, and that's kind of changed the story here for the last 6 months.
Yes, exactly. There's actually been two bailouts, and now we're about to embark on a third. There was a bailout in 2010 and another one in 2012. I think the total amount of those bailouts was something on the order of 240 billion euros. So Greece had two rounds of funding, and the whole idea was that during that period they would engage in A, austerity measures, and B, restructuring of the economy that would make their debt sustainable and restore economic growth. And then this is really the big debate that's been going on. Has austerity made things worse rather than helping? And the fact is that Greece has endured what is the equivalent of the Great Depression in the United States in the early 1930s. And the difference is, if you look at a graph of U.S. economic growth during the Depression era, what you see right around the sixth year is a sharp upturn toward recovery. Greece has not yet experienced that, and in fact, they're expected to suffer further contraction of their economy this year as a consequence of more austerity measures.
Okay, but you mentioned that there was reason to be hopeful, that things are potentially going to be positive going forward.
Well, I did. I said that hope was a theme. I think it's a quest for hope. I'm not sure yet what the source of hope is. I think it's a little bit difficult to be hopeful. On the other hand, one probably shouldn't be exclusively negative about the situation. The fact is that even the current prime minister, who is making the case for the structural reforms that Eurozone partners have called for, when he makes that case in parliament, he is saying that he doesn't believe that these measures are going to help the Greek economy. However, it's the only course available to Greece. They have to accept these measures, undertake them to get the next bailout. And so it's not clear that the measures Greece is now undertaking are going to really turn things around. And again, the question is, where does hope come from? The current government, which was elected back in January, I think was elected precisely because the Greek people desperately needed a source of hope. And this was a government that said, we are going to address the issue of austerity and moderate the austerity and bring hope to the Greek people. So far, they've not succeeded in doing that. And frankly, their chances of success were poor from the start.
Well, one of the alternatives is that they should leave the Eurozone. Do we actually foresee that as a possibility? Could that actually happen?
I have to admit that I've been someone who, in all the classes I've taught and all the discussions I've had of this, have insisted that Greece will not leave the Eurozone. However, I don't think we can rule it out. There's no mechanism for kicking a country out of the Eurozone. However, the situation that we saw back around July 12th was one in which, in that late night session with the Eurozone partners, if they had not reached agreement, Greek banks would run out of euros. They would basically have to issue IOUs, which would be essentially an alternative currency, and they would have had no choice but to leave the Eurozone without some kind of emergency assistance. So they could have been forced out by those circumstances. That didn't happen. I think it's still possible that it could happen. However, the reason why I've consistently argued that I don't expect that to happen is one has to remember that this is a political project as much as an economic project. And there is a political commitment to making it work. I think this is one of the casualties in some sense of this last summit meeting, and that is that people began to question whether or not the German government was still upholding this commitment to making it work.
Okay, well, we'll definitely continue to watch this story. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can share your thoughts about this conversation by sending us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or by leaving a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, sitting in today for Suzette Gerlot. A lack of proper sanitation facilities is a major global health issue. A lack of proper sanitation facilities is a major global health issue. Contributing to this is the fact that nearly 9.5 million people still practice open defecation. It's especially problematic in India, despite governmental programs to promote proper sanitation. Geographer Kathleen O'Reilly studies health and development at Texas A&M University, including the social dynamics of sanitation practices in India. She spoke with our host, Suzette Gerlot.
Kathleen O'Reilly, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Kathleen, you do work as a geographer on issues of sanitation and water, clean water practices in urban and rural India. So can we just start with what are we talking about here? I mean, we know, and I know you've written about the notion that there's still a practice of open defecation in India. Can you talk to us a little bit about how and why that happens and what some of the consequences of that are before we talk about kind of, you know, where you're headed with that kind of study?
The easiest way to talk about open defecation in India is simply to say most people in India are defecating in the open. You can talk about numbers, but I think most says quite a lot. Now, most of those people are living in rural areas. What's concerning is that while the numbers of people in rural India who don't have toilets, who aren't using sanitation, seems to be declining. Those numbers are actually going up in urban areas. And in general, we're always concerned about high population densities and open defecation, people and feces on the landscape being more or less in close proximity to each other. So what we're talking about is the spread of disease, particularly diarrheal disease, which can be deadly to children under five. But we're also talking about loss of health. We're talking about loss of labor time. So all of those things, public health in general, make it really important to have sanitation available to people and also to be encouraging them to use it.
So you mentioned that it's happening more in the urban areas. Is this because of migration, perhaps, with people moving from rural areas to urban areas? And so you're seeing an increase in this type of activity there?
Right. India is a rapidly urbanizing state, and the numbers for urban dwellers without sanitation is exactly that, people migrating from rural areas into urban areas, often in slums, often on the periphery of cities.
So you mentioned the obviously health consequences, disease consequences, loss of labor time because of disease and health insecurity, that we need to be concerned about this. But I thought it was interesting that you've demonstrated in your work that even when sanitation is available, we don't necessarily see them taking advantage of it. So talk a little bit about how this has become ingrained in perhaps a cultural practice. Is that the case? Or even is it a lack of education? Or what is it that even when they have proper toilets available to them, they still choose not to use them?
Mm-hmm. It's a really complicated answer to that question. So let me talk about a few things that I've gotten out of my own work. One of the things is that people enjoy open defecation. It's the difference between, if they have a toilet at home, it's the difference between, as they would put it, you know, sitting inside a stinky box compared to being out in the open, enjoying the fresh air, having the ability to go for a walk, that kind of enjoyment. I think it's important to think about it as a preference because people are choosing this. And to do so is a daily choice. So that's something else that matters. Those who go for open defecation might find that with one toilet in the family, there isn't time to wait if one has to go off to work or something like that. Other things that matter, yes, there seems to be little understanding, especially in rural India, about disease, you know, what it means for feces to actually be on the landscape. So health concerns are not a reason for people to stop going for open defecation. There's also concerns that the toilet they have is not going to enable them to use it indefinitely on into the future. And this is something that I think people in North America can relate to. We are used to having a sustainable toilet system. We're never going to be able to stop using it. But pit latrines are the norm in rural India, and people have concerns about the pits filling up. So without a way to easily empty those pits, it's another reason to go for open defecation instead.
That's Kathleen O'Reilly, a geographer who studies how gender and social norms influence the use of toilets in rural India. We'll hear more of her conversation with Suzette Gerlot after a short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Gerlot. Today we've been hearing from Texas A&M geographer Kathleen O'Reilly about the health and sanitation problems in rural India. Before the break, she was telling Suzette about why open defecation is so common in India and some of the issues with convincing rural communities to use toilets.
So as far as moving people in that direction, and I don't know if education is the right word to use in terms of making sure that people are aware of the fact that there are health and disease and other consequences to open defecation. You talk about in some of your work the use of social pressure and how, you know, once some people, I guess, are converted to using proper sanitation practices, that it's more likely then to spread. Can you talk a little bit about how that works? And this is a matter, I guess, of socialization?
Sure. One of the things that I've learned from my work in West Bengal and Himachal Pradesh, where toilet building interventions were successful, was that in a kind of keeping up with the Joneses way, families wanted to build latrines because they didn't want to be the only ones without. And neighbors would pressure other neighbors to build toilets and then to use them. Almost like a tipping point. Families were ready to talk to their neighbors about having a toilet and using it because of not necessarily the health effects, although these communities were aware of those things. So education does matter. But also for the aesthetics of it. You know, most of us are using toilets. You should too.
In some of your work, you've focused on women in particular and how women are affected by this. So can you tell us a little bit about how this is a women's issue? Is it a gendered issue? I mean, obviously, we all go to the toilet, men and women. So how does this issue affect women more so than men, or does it?
Mm-hmm. Well, men are the least likely to use toilets, even if they have one at home. Women's concerns are both individual and social. And of course, those two things overlap. In India, there are much greater constraints on what spaces women are allowed to occupy. There are greater pressures about modesty in public. So, and then, of course, there's the threat of physical violence.
I was going to ask if this was also a safety and security issue for
mm-hmm.
women.
Yes, most definitely. So women are more likely to use toilets if they have access to them because of this privacy, convenience, and safety issues. Their work is mostly inside the household. I'm not saying that women don't work outside the house. But one of the things we heard often from women was, I like having the toilet because it means that I can be cooking, and if I need to go, I can just go and come right back. If I have childcare responsibilities, I'm not gone for long, or it's not necessary to take the children out for open defecation and then come back, those kinds of time-saving measures. But the gendered aspect is most definitely about women's position in society, which is subordinate to men. They do not have the same freedoms of movement, and they certainly don't have the same kinds of physical security that men do. On the other hand, I am concerned about toilet building for women, and there's certainly been movements to target women as the reason to build a toilet at home. Those may be effective, but my concern is for the disappearance of women from the public sphere, that while going for open defecation is a small part of how a woman might be seen in public, might have some mobility out of the house, to build a toilet, particularly in the study area in Rajasthan, building a toilet meant that women really never had a reason to leave the house. And that is of concern. That's concerning.
It's interesting to think of the negative social consequences, as you're pointing out, of limiting women's access to the public, even if we are talking about to get out to use the toilet. It's really remarkable to think about it along those lines. Well, you've also spent a lot of time in India working with non-governmental organizations and others who – I loved how you put it earlier. You're talking about toilet intervention and you know, trying to encourage people, men and women, I presume, to use toilets as opposed to open defecation. But how supportive is the Indian government and how involved are they in providing the resources and the services, the sewer lines, the ability to even have, toilet capability or the pit latrines or what have you? I mean, how involved is the Indian government in this?
Well, the Indian government has run a total sanitation campaign for India at large for decades. Narendra Modi, since he's been in power as the prime minister, has stated many times publicly that this is a focus for him. However, it takes many layers of government to make a toilet intervention work, not only to build the kinds of toilets that people want to use, but also to get the word out in terms of education, widening social pressure, so that people will use these facilities. And in urban India, there is a real tension between what municipal governments want, which is not necessarily to have slums. That's held in tension with holding back services from those slums in anticipation that those slums will eventually be torn down and the people living in them will be relocated. So by withholding services like water provision or putting in sewer pipes and things like that, it means that the government has not committed itself to that slum being a permanent fixture. And that creates a lot of uncertainty for the people who live there. It certainly creates the kind of landscape that neither slum dwellers nor elites or middle class citizens in the city want to deal with.
So I know we've been talking about India and that you're an expert on India and spent most of your time there. But is this a larger issue that goes beyond India? Do you see these same types of practices and concerns in other areas that might even just make this a larger kind of global development issue?
It's definitely a global development issue. India is usually pointed out as the state with the worst problems, but there are places around the world that have issues with open defecation, both in cities and in rural issues. It is most definitely a global problem, and I think the community of scholars, activists, and policymakers working on this topic are all hoping that this body of knowledge can come together and be globally applicable. Context is always important, but I think we're all working toward some general solutions.
Well, Kathleen, I know this is a difficult subject often to talk about and a little sensitive perhaps to talk about the toilet, but it's something very important, and I appreciate you sharing that with us so that we can understand more about some of these important global development issues. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Kathleen O'Reilly, a geographer at Texas A&M University who studies the social impacts of health development projects in India. If you'd like to know more about her research, you can visit the Worldviews page of kgou.org. While you're there, you can also listen to any of our past episodes and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a production of KGOU in collaboration with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupree conducted the research for this interview, writes our digital content, and produced this episode with oversight from Brian Hardzinski. For Suzette Gerlot and Mitchell Smith, I'm Rebecca Cruz.